are the headlines. Iran says it has successfully produced uranium enriched to 60% purity at its Natanz nuclear facility. The UN warns of a worsening humanitarian crisis in Yemen amid a surge in coronavirus cases in the war-torn country. And U.S. police say at least 8 people have been killed and many more injured in a mass shooting in the U.S. city of Indianapolis. My name is Oray Zahedi. Welcome. Our top story, Iran says it has produced uranium enriched to 60% purity. Head of Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Ali Akbar Salehi, said the enrichment is underway at the Natanz nuclear facility. He said the process continues despite Sunday's sabotage act on Natanz. Mr. Salehi said uranium enrichment at 20% purity is underway as well and stressed Iran is capable of enriching uranium at any level. The news of 60% enrichment was first announced by Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Qalibaf earlier on Friday. Iran began the process on Wednesday. Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has said the measure is in line with Iran's commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Tehran has said the move is in response to the weekend attack at Natanz. Iran has called the attack nuclear terrorism and blamed Israel. To discuss this a little bit further, I'm going to bring in my own teacher at the university, Dr. Syed Mohammad Marandi. He is the university professor and, of course, a political analyst, a prominent one for that matter. He joins us via Skype out of Tehran. Professor, it's good to see you. Tell us the importance, the significance that it holds in itself, especially the 60%, as well as the timing of this.
Besides the scientific achievement and the fact that this uranium that's been enriched at 60% will be used for medical purposes, it is a very powerful and political response to the terrorist attack carried out at Natanz by the Israeli regime with the support of the United States. And the reason why I say they had the support of the United States was that the attack came literally hours before the U.S. Secretary of Defense entered Tel Aviv, and it's obvious that the Israeli regime would never carry out an attack without a consultation and a green light first, especially at such a moment when the Secretary of Defense of the United States is arriving in that country. So it's a powerful response. The Iranians are telling the Israeli regime, the Americans and the Europeans, that they will not be intimidated, they will not be deterred, and the only way forward, if they still want a nuclear deal, is full implementation by the United States and the Europeans, plus verification.
Of course, you mentioned the scientific importance as well as, the capabilities of the country to be able to be in the spectrum. But, Doctor, what do you think specifically about the ongoing JCPOA negotiations? What kind of leverage do you think such an announcement and, you know, turning it into reality just in 2 days will actually give a fuller hand, so to speak, to the Iranian negotiators in Vienna?
I think it definitely strengthens their hand because it's sending a message to the Americans and the Europeans that any form of intimidation, any form of espionage that leads to terrorism or destruction will lead to an Iranian response that will be more severe and more heavy-handed. So not only have the Iranians decided to enrich uranium at 60% now, thanks to the Israeli and the American regimes carried out, but they will replace the damaged centrifuges, which are the older generation centrifuges, with state-of-the-art centrifuges. So these are two responses. In addition to that, the attacks on Iranian shipping has been, we've seen a response where Israeli ships have been struck, and also we see events unfolding elsewhere in the region which are detrimental to the interests of the Israeli regime and the United States. So the maximum pressure campaign that was initiated by the United States is now seeing pushback. And I think the Americans, if they look carefully, they'll see that the Iranians are very determined. So the smart thing for the Americans and the Europeans to do is to put aside the propaganda, put aside the idea that they will be able to get new concessions from Iran, and abide by their agreement, fully abide by the nuclear deal. The nuclear deal is not perfect for Iran. It is a flawed deal, but we accepted it. Now they have to accept it. Otherwise, the Iranians will not implement the deal at all, and Iran will move on.
Mm-hmm. Many, many thanks, Professor Mohammad Marandi with the University of Tehran. He's a university professor and a political analyst. Thank you very, very much. It was good to see you. Have a good Friday, Professor. See you next time. The UN says the world's largest humanitarian crisis in Yemen is getting even worse, with the pandemic roaring back in recent weeks. UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock said cases are surging in Yemen, which already faces a large-scale famine. He said health facilities and hospitals have to turn people away because they lack resources. Mr. Lowcock was addressing a UN Security Council meeting. He said tens of thousands of Yemenis are already starving to death, with another 5 million just a step behind. Lowcock called for urgent action to stop the unfolding catastrophe. Yemen's been devastated by war waged by its northern neighbor, Saudi Arabia, 6 years ago. The Yemeni military says it has conducted new attacks against positions inside Saudi Arabia. It says missiles and drones hit a facility belonging to Saudi oil giant Aramco. Sensitive targets were also hit in the kingdom's southwestern Jizan region. Abdul Latif al-Washali is in Sana'a.
The Yemeni army said it has launched fresh attacks on Saudi Arabia using 11 missiles and drones against a facility belonging to Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil giant and other sensitive targets in Jizan. It was announced in a tweet by the spokesman for the Yemeni armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Saria. Saria said Force Samad 3 and Qasif K2 drones were also used in the attacks.
This is a message to Saudi Arabia that it must stop its war and lift its blockade on the Yemeni people. The Saudis must allow the fuel ships to enter Yemen, otherwise the next attacks will be worse for them. We targeted Aramco, which is the backbone of the Saudi Arabia and the global economy. We'll continue attacks and target vital installations.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army said the attack came in retaliation for the latest Saudi crime against civilians in Sada in northern Yemen that killed 2 children and wounded 4 others, including a woman. Saria vowed wider and larger attacks until the war is stopped.
Fuel is one of the main sources of life in the world, and today there is a blockade on Yemen, and oil ships are being prevented from entering the country. Many health centers in Yemen have stopped providing services due to lack of fuel. So the battle is economic, and we will continue targeting Aramco until it stops working. It is our right to fight back.
Yemen's armed forces on Monday launched an attack against Aramco's refineries in Jeddah and Jubail with 10 drones of Samad 3 type and caused a heavy blow to the Saudi economy. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Yemenis say the army has the right to target Saudi facilities to respond to the crimes committed against Yemeni civilians. They have also made it clear that their attacks against Riyadh will persist until the war is stopped. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The United States has a new plan for ending its longest war. The newly announced plan could mark a new chapter for Afghans, but the new pull-out timetable has proved controversial.
The war in Afghanistan has been a major foreign policy challenge for several U.S. presidents. The war, which began in 2001 under former President George W. Bush, has killed some 2,300 U.S. troops and cost American taxpayers more than $2 trillion. The protracted conflict has been widely described as futile. This week, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that America will finally withdraw all of its forces from Afghanistan in 2021.
After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home.
Several thousand American forces remain part of the 9,600-strong NATO mission there. Under Biden's plan, the withdrawal is scheduled to begin on May the 1st and will be completed in September. The U.S. president seems confident about his withdrawal plan, but his initiative has been met with criticism. The Taliban called for the U.S. to abide by an agreement with the group, which was brokered in Doha, Qatar, last year. The U.S. under former President Donald Trump had agreed to pull out all troops from Afghanistan by May the 1st. The militant group warned that if the Doha agreement is breached, those who fail to comply with the deal will be held responsible for any possible problems. Russia's foreign ministry also said the newly announced withdrawal strategy violates America's previous promises. Meanwhile, the pullout plan comes at a time when Taliban militants are in control of large parts of Afghanistan after nearly two decades of the U.S.-led war against them.
No one knows what the future holds for Afghanistan. The war-ravaged nation faces a very long list of problems, such as insecurity, poverty, and unemployment. The situation requires the Taliban and the government in Kabul to work together when foreign forces leave later on this year. How will Afghanistan deal with the trail of destruction left by America's longest war? Here's a report.
The almost 20-year war has wreaked havoc in Afghanistan and claimed tens of thousands of lives. Taliban militants who were forced out of power by the U.S. invasion in 2001 proved resilient and clawed back large parts of Afghanistan from foreign and government forces, especially in recent years. They are now in control of important parts of the country. They seem to be an indispensable part of Afghanistan's future. Critics of America's foreign policy say this exposes the futility of U.S. militarism in the region.
I believe that this conflict, when you analyze it, the only proper way to state it is that it was a total failure. The United States will try to spin this into a complicated story, into saying, you know, it's complicated, nobody, there are no clear winners. But you think about the fact that they did the same similar thing even in Vietnam when the Americans were dealt a sound crushing defeat.
The U.S.-led military campaign failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with a long list of problems such as poverty, unemployment, and illicit opium production. Some even go so far as to call war-torn Afghanistan a failed state. Meanwhile, the insecurity has provided a fertile ground for the growth of militant groups more extreme than the Taliban. Now foreign forces are finally planning to leave. Who is responsible for the mess that they're leaving behind? It's the Afghan people who have to put up with the unending misery every day. The departure of foreign forces this year could mark a new chapter for Afghans. Observers believe Afghans across the country, whether in the ranks of the Taliban or the government, have to put aside their differences and work together if they really want a future for their country.
Police in the U.S. city of Indianapolis say 8 people have been killed in a mass shooting there. Authorities are aware of multiple other injured victims in hospitals. One of them is in critical condition. That's according to the Indianapolis Police Department. They say a gunman opened fire at a FedEx facility near the city's international airport late on Thursday. Police believe the gunman died by suicide. They say there is no longer active threat to public safety. Council in the U.S. and Chicago, authorities have released a police body camera video that captured the deadly U.S. police shooting of a 13-year-old Hispanic boy last month. Chicago's Civilian Office of Police Accountability also released other material related to the killing. They include more body cam videos from involved and responding police officers, as well as four third-party videos. Adam Toledo was shot in the chest by an unidentified police officer in Chicago on March the 29th. Police said Toledo was armed with a handgun. That has been rejected by a lawyer for the victim's family.
Adam, during his last second of life, did not have a gun in his hand. The officer screamed at him, "Show me your hands." Adam complied, turned around. His hands were empty when he was shot in the chest at the hands of the officer.
The Chicago mayor has also said she watched a video but saw no evidence that Toledo shot at officers. Officials in Chicago are now preparing for civil unrest following the release of the footage. Tensions have already run high in many U.S. cities over racism and police brutality. The tensions began to rise following police's killing of African-American George Floyd last year. A series of recent fatal shootings have further escalated anti-racism sentiments. And that's it with international news.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Has been subject to verification since the JCPOA signing in 2015, and constant checks by the UN's nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, have verified 15 times that Iran has been in compliance with that deal. But the tables have turned. Iran got barely anything more than promises for its compliance. Now, it will return to full commitment only if the U.S. lifts sanctions off this country in one sweeping move. It has agreed to nothing else. It may mean leaving with nothing for both sides, but Iran is adamant it's not going to get bitten again. It insists this time this country will be doing the verifying. It will verify sanctions have been lifted, and only then will it start reversing back into its nuclear commitments to the deal. So far, Iranian strategy has at least gotten the U.S. seriously thinking, even perhaps contemplating taking the first step to revive the JCPOA, or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran nuclear deal. I'm Leila Faramarzi. Iran's adamance in performing checks and balances before recommitting stems from a profound distrust for the U.S. The U.S. earned this distrust on several occasions, even before the 1979 Islamic Revolution, when Iran and America were still fast friends. Mr. Abolfat is a political analyst, one of the best at national TV, so you can imagine his all-round detailed vision of matters in his domain. Let's hear his take at Press TV Studios.
Would things have been any different if the Shah were in place, the friend of America? Because even then, they wouldn't have allowed us nuclear technology.
There have been many indicators that the Americans were taking measures to prevent Iran from acquiring peaceful nuclear technology. Americans themselves did not engage with Iran, but the Germans signed a contract to build the Bushehr power plant. They did their utmost to ensure that Iran wouldn't advance past a certain point. Evidence suggests if it wasn't for the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Americans wouldn't let Iran acquire peaceful nuclear technology.
Mr. Izadi is professor of international studies. He often comes up with the unexpected, but with logical reason attached. It was worth the trek out into center-west Tehran.
What lessons would you say Iran's JCPOA experience with the U.S. has borne for the world?
The point that Biden and people like Antony Blinken were making before they got into office about Trump leaving the agreement is actually true. That if countries realize that you make an agreement with one administration, and once that administration leaves, the agreement is nullified by the next administration, no one is going to be able to make any agreements with the United States. So U.S. says that it's an important country, but when it comes to international agreements, it acts like a banana republic.
Even before the Trump administration's reimposition of secondary sanctions in May 2018, after they unilaterally pulled out of the nuclear deal, Iran was not receiving the full benefits of sanctions relief. The main impediment was that major banks were reluctant to facilitate transactions or provide financing for Iran-linked projects. So most major deals signed with a vision of the JCPOA working hit a roadblock. Iran had placed orders for Boeing and Airbus aircraft, had attempted joint ventures with automakers Peugeot and Renault and Daimler. It had struck energy deals with Total and CNPC and rail projects with Siemens and Alstom. But even before Trump, a shady Republican, was elected to office, they lost faith in the nuclear deal and Iran's economic stability. As expected, they thought it too risky to venture into Iranian waters. Mr. Ajorlu is editor-in-chief of Mosallas magazine. He generously welcomed us to review and weigh the JCPOA's chances with us.
You see, in the past 4 or 5 years, Europe has talked about INSTEX and the revival of the JCPOA. Mr. Rouhani downplayed the importance of the matter, saying that the P5 plus 1 has turned to P4 plus 1. But we don't look at the issue optimistically. In the past 2 or 3 years, we have witnessed the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Mr. Fakhrizadeh. There has also been the recent incident at Natanz. We can't take these lightly just because we are negotiating with Europe. Europe is basically powerless.
Former U.S. President Trump renewed Iran's distrust in 2018, not just by pulling out of the deal and comically reimposing U.N. sanctions. As Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif put it, the U.S. had imposed, reimposed, or relabeled some 1,600 sanctions on Iran, inflicting $1 trillion worth of direct and indirect economic damage on this country. In fact, Trump's scorched-earth sanctions policy has done everything to make it impossible for President Biden to return to the JCPOA. At least, that's what it aimed for.
We don't know if Biden wants to, because Biden generally belongs to the right wing of the Democratic Party. He's very close to the Israelis, and whether he wants to go back to JCPOA is very much in doubt.
If there's any chance the JCPOA can be brought up to speed with what was intended, Iran will make sure that actually happens. Sanction lifting has to happen in action and practice, and not just on paper. And sanction lifting verification will take time. Parliament estimates 3 to 6 months. And it insists verification has to be continual, for example, once every 6 months, in order to make sure Iran's economic interests, financial interests, are being secured.
Barack Obama, America's signing president himself, said the deal was not built on trust but verification of compliance. So Iran was under constant surveillance by the IAEA. Now, Iran expects to do the surveillance. One option might be to establish a new panel of experts or special rapporteur at the United Nations, responsible for gathering, interpreting, and assessing evidence on the implementation of sanctions relief.
There's always talk of the IAEA confirming Iran's conformity with the JCPOA. Can we create no council, international council, to keep an eye on other parties to the deal?
Unfortunately, this is the bitter reality of the international system. We aren't dealing with a just system. The great powers abuse their authority and follow international law wherever it's politically expedient, and disregard it when it's not to their benefit. There is a lack of a higher authority to prosecute those countries. Of course, there is an international court of justice and criminal court, but Americans often do not comply with their rulings.
Verification mean? It means Iran must be able to sign contracts, export oil, and bring in the revenues via banking channels or find other uses for them. Let's not forget the JCPOA was intended to boost Iran's economy and foreign trade relations in return for this country limiting its nuclear program, which it has maintained is for peaceful purposes.
I think we certainly can regain our power by taking an appropriate approach and analysis of the regional issues. But today, the Iranian people are feeling psychological and economic insecurities. This is the result of believing that dealing with the U.S. will solve all the problems. They tried it out and realized that it wasn't possible. Didn't Mr. Biden say he would return to the JCPOA once he takes office? Why hasn't he returned? Why is he saying he won't resume full compliance until Iran does? We have the experience of drawing up a legal contract and signing and verifying it. But after all that, they might tear the agreement apart someday. There is no guarantee in place whatsoever.
Why the United Nations to establish such a verification mechanism? Some reasons are, first, the nuclear deal is enshrined in United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. That obligates promoting and facilitating the development of normal economic and trade contacts and cooperation with Iran. Second, the IAEA, a United Nations agency, is already involved in verifying half of the nuclear deal's quid pro quo. Third, Iran has itself turned to United Nations bodies to say file a suit at the International Court of Justice against the U.S. for not holding its end of the bargain with the JCPOA. Fourth, the issue of sanctions relief impacts Iran's relationships with the wider international community. I'm talking non-JCPOA countries that wouldn't want to raise their concerns at a forum dominated by the U.S. Non-partial countries that share economic interests with Iran and cannot afford the blow of secondary U.S. sanctions imposed on dealing with Iran are countries such as Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and North Korea.
As a matter of fact, this is how we should speak to the people. We must explain that our attempts at establishing ties with the West have hurt us. We have shown goodwill to the West, Europe, US, Russia and China. But the upshot was more sanctions on the oil and banking sectors. Yet we remain committed to the agreement. More importantly, there have been a few terror attacks, both against our high-ranking officials and our nuclear sites. In my opinion, we need to send the messages through political, military and security means. We can't stop at the political level. We can define new relations on an international level.
The insurance and shipment of Iranian oil tankers, as well as the global money transfer SWIFT mechanism, are among Iran's top priorities in securing oil sales and incoming petrodollars. It is being discussed what should be done regarding Iran's technical commitments and how they be carried out in case a party falls short on their promise. This, Kazem Gharibabadi said of the early April nuclear talks in Vienna. Gharibabadi is Iran's ambassador to the UN's nuclear watchdog and a delegation member to the said Vienna talks, at which Iran explored options to prevent a potential repeat of what happened in 2018. That is when Donald Trump binned the nuclear deal and yet expected to have a say in its implementation.
When they say you come and talk to us, what they actually mean is that you come and give us more concessions, give us more stuff. And Iran is not interested in doing that because the concessions that Iran gave last time resulted in almost nothing for Iran. So why would you want to sit down with the same people that you gave them concessions before and they didn't do much?
Plenty more to be said, but first a quick look at other media outlets to see what others have to say on our affairs. And here's what they actually say in words. Mehr News makes a mention of Iran's eastern partners to the JCPOA who want to help bring the deal up to scratch. Moscow doing its utmost to find solution to JCPOA revival. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said he accepts the U.S. State Department's assessment of the process, which it described as difficult. Firstly, because there is no trust between Tehran and Washington, and obviously there can be no such trust. That is why it is very difficult to reach any agreement. Second, actions need to be verified, which is a very sensitive and complex issue. Even without this, the process is very difficult because there is so much deviation from the initial characteristics of the JCPOA that returning to the original state requires great political will, the Russian official said. We've got Reuters that quotes the French foreign minister on how tactical problems and Iranian politics are hindering revival of nuclear talks. France's foreign minister said the efforts to revive nuclear talks with Iran were being held up by tactical problems and the domestic situation in Iran ahead of its presidential election in June. There's a tactical problem and also an internal issue in Iran, which is in a particular situation because we are quite close to the presidential election in June. This, Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian told a hearing at the French Senate. He did not say what the tactical problem was, but added that while there was a stated will to return to talks, tensions remained, and it was urgent to move forward to calm the situation. Iran's Tasnim News says how time matters. Dragging feet on Iran sanctions removal, ruining chances of JCPOA revival, said the spokesman for the Iranian administration. He warned the violators of the 2015 nuclear deal that procrastination in lifting the sanctions against Tehran would ruin the opportunity for the revival of the accord. Speaking at a press conference, Ali Rabi advised the violators of the JCPOA to seize the opportunity to salvage the nuclear deal by terminating sanctions on Iran. They should know that every day of further delay in lifting the sanctions against Iran will only dim the chances of revival of the JCPOA as the first and last solution available for putting aside the differences, but also push them away from a better prospect for relations with Iran, he warned. The spokesperson also made it clear that the only logical option for the U.S. administration is to rejoin the JCPOA and fully end the sanctions on Iran. And that would be it for this section. Do stay tuned.
As the Vienna nuclear talks proceeded, Iran did say it was in no hurry for results. Results are what it is looking for, but if the U.S. must lose time, Iran will carry on with enriching uranium to levels higher than that stipulated in the nuclear deal. That's to say, it is producing and storing enriched uranium with a 20% purity level, breaking the 3.67% enrichment parameter set by the deal. Iran might even go up to 60% purification if the country needs it.
Would you say Israel might achieve its goal? Can it put a spanner in the works with Iran's talks with JCPOA partners?
Obviously, it's this type of terrorist act is not going to stop Iran's nuclear program. As you saw, Dr. Salehi, the head of Iran's Atomic Energy Agency, said that they are building facilities inside the mountains near Natanz, near the current nuclear site. Israel is actually making Iran's nuclear program stronger.
Sunday, 11th April, the electrical grid of the Natanz nuclear site was disrupted. This coincided with the anniversary of the National Day of Nuclear Technology in Iran and during this country's efforts to push the West into lifting sanctions. Bit of a coincidence, given disruption at Natanz has been one of the methods of sabotage in this strategic facility for many years. Only last July, a mysterious explosion shook the plant. Also on Tuesday, as Vienna talks began to revive U.S. participation in the JCPOA, an Iranian vessel stationed in the Red Sea was damaged by an apparent Israeli mine attack. With such bad will in Iran's backyard, the U.S. will have to try that much harder to rekindle the deal.
You know, the Israelis have been saying this for some time, that in order to slow down Iran's nuclear program, or in order to stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, you don't have to give Iran concessions. You don't have to negotiate with Iran. You don't need to go to Vienna. You can just destroy things. You can engage in terrorism. You can kill Iranian scientists. You can blow up Iranian nuclear sites.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, in his weekly press briefing on Monday, April the 12th, hinted that Israel might be behind Natanz nuclear plant incident, which happened the day before the presser. He elaborated on the sabotage in Natanz nuclear facility in central Iran, saying that many sources link the sabotage operation to the Israeli regime, which had frequently threatened to run such operations against Iran. This is not going to impact Iran's nuclear capability. All centrifuges unplugged were of the old IR-1 type and will be replaced by advanced machines. Iran is not going to be trapped. The Israeli regime takes revenge on Iranian people for their patience and sage behavior. Iran would take revenge in appropriate time.
It's typical of the Israeli regime to commit assassinations and acts of sabotage and refuse to assume responsibility for them. Their media, however, report that it was their doing. Our security institutions also know who the culprit has been. There must be a reciprocal action, or else our silence might send a bad signal to them.
There's no touching between Iran and America. Even with the Vienna talks, Iran refrained from indirect talks even. How it went is that the 4+1 states spoke separately to Iranian and to American representatives and brought the results to each of the two separately.
The U.S. talks tough, but it's willing to hold even long-distance talks with Iran to get back into the JCPOA one way or another. Can you comment on that, please?
Last week, we had Republican senators, members of the House, writing a letter to Biden that whatever agreement you will have with Iran, it's going to end once we go back to the White House. And they may go back to the White House in 2024. Who knows whether Biden is going to get reelected or he's going to be alive, or, you know, we don't know. So that's another criteria in Iranian leaders' calculation.
Foreign Minister Zarif tweeted, the aim of the meeting would be to rapidly finalize sanction lifting and nuclear measures for choreographed removal of all sanctions, followed by Iran seizing remedial measures. No Iran-US meeting, unnecessary, he added. Even Western European parties to the deal couldn't or wouldn't do much to find a way around U.S. sanctions to fulfill their trade commitments to Iran under the deal. So, Iran decided to give them time in inching out of its commitments one step at a time, whilst at the same time finding a way around sanctions itself. Fellow Easterners have cooperated in the process, and Iran is still selling oil.
Iran's definite stance for return to JCPOA is that the U.S. remove all sanctions, once and for all. How did Iran come to this distrust for the U.S.?
You see, Donald Trump was warned against the same things when he was trying to carry out his threats. Many warned the then-U.S. administration that its maximum pressure campaign wouldn't necessarily work. Iran has been under sanctions for over 40 years and has mastered ways to circumvent them. Many countries are now unwilling to side with the U.S. The international system has been different at the start of the third decade of the current century compared to the first decade.
To China, Iran has been exporting oil openly, up to over a million barrels a day, reportedly. And late March, it even signed a 25-year accord with China to cover any and all economic and infrastructural aspects of cooperation, as well as military cooperation. This has been much to the dismay of the West and Israel. Hence, verbal and practical sabotage of the Sino-Iranian agreement. Proponents say Iran will benefit from turning east, while critics say Iran may be giving up too much in its quest to boost ties with China. Not really. Iran just has to be alert to details, such as the importance of Chinese companies employing also Iranians at all levels.
Given what you say and the fact that Iran has found some ways around sanctions, what means of pressure have remained for the West?
You see, the U.S. elite is acknowledging this in their media. Just a few days ago, there was an article in the New York Times warning that the Biden administration didn't have many options available to it anymore. It said the so-called maximum pressure campaign hasn't worked and Iran has increased its nuclear capacity both qualitatively and quantitatively. The American elite is claiming, based on their interpretation of Tehran's capacities, that Iran is on the verge of building a nuclear weapon. Therefore, they argue that U.S. needs to enter into an agreement with Iran as soon as possible.
In all, early April saw Iranian crude production rise in the latest months, hitting 2.14 million barrels a day in February. And that's according to the latest S&P Global Platts survey of the OPEC output. OPEC stands for Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. To end with a taste of the mood in Iran's governing circles, the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, said, "I've heard some Americans say today's situation is different from when JCPOA was signed in 2015-2016, and some JCPOA articles must be changed." That's true. During this time, a government took office in the U.S. that disgraced and humiliated the U.S., but Iran has earned more power and reinvigorated. So, if a change is to be made, it should be to the benefit of Iran.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Don't forget to tune in again at the same times next week and each week after, as our narrative is ongoing. Bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Islam takes care of the relations with womb relatives. It summons Muslims to cling to them, for they strengthen the family and lead the community to fruitful results. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, urged the Muslims to cleave to them. He, peace be upon him, said, "Relations with blood relatives increase acts, develop properties, repel the tribulation, make easy the reckoning, and postpone the fixed term of death."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam urged his companions on many occasions to treat people according to the rules of Islamic social conduct. It's interesting, but in one conversation, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam is speaking with Abu Hamza, one of his more renowned companions. And so he was talking about things that will keep the oppressive ruler, the tyrant ruler, away from one, as well as keeping the Satan, Shaitan, away from you. Now, when talking about the things which keep away an oppressive ruler and Satan from one, Imam al-Baqir talked about giving alms, giving charity early in the morning. He also talked about loving one another and also to help one another with good deeds. And finally, one of the things that Imam al-Baqir said to Abu Hamza regarding what drives away an oppressive ruler and the Satan from you is to insist on Allah in asking for forgiveness. For such insistence on the forgiveness to be acquired from Allah erases one's sins. And so, dear friends, of course, the more we are in repentance, the more we ask for forgiveness, the more we realize that we have committed bad deeds, we have committed errors, we have committed mistakes. And still, we will be moved towards remembering how bad the disobedience of Allah is, which of course in turn will help us to not disobey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
these beautiful words given to us in this dialogue by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
This Sahabi, worth mentioning here from the fifth Imam, is not a muhaddis, is not a faqih, is not a theologian, and that's Kumayt al-Asadi. He was a poet. And we know that poetry is actually a very powerful element of any society. Sometimes you can know whether a community is alive or dead by the life or death of poetry in that community, or the language that they speak. Kumayt al-Asadi basically was a very powerful shair of the Umayyad time. This is the time of the Imam. And he actually used his talent of poetry in defending the Shia Mazhab, in promoting the cause of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, and in opposing the Umayyad injustice and zulm. And because of that, he was always in the most, you know, wanted list of the Khulafa of Banu Umayyah. They didn't like him. And there is one very interesting incident where you see even where Imam is basically praising and promoting the talent of poetry. At the time of Hajj, Imam had gone there, and Kumayt al-Asadi was also there in Masjid al-Haram by the Kaaba. They're sitting there, and Kumayt starts reciting poetry in the praise of the Imams, especially the fifth Imam. Imam looked at him, became so pleased. Looking towards the Kaaba, raising his hand, he says, Allahumma al-Kumayt, O Allah, send your mercy on Kumayt. And he repeated this dua three times. And so he insisted, I have a request. I want one of the shirts that you already used. Give that to me. So he asked for something, not a material thing. He says, I want a shirt that you have used. Why? Because he wanted to use as a tawassul and shafa'at for himself, that he be buried with that in his grave. You know, this is where we see the example of what we call Sirati Amali of the Imam. He didn't refuse. Imam gave him one of his shirts. And people would say, well, you know, this is all shirk and bid'at and this and that. No. It is nisbat. Nisbat means the relationship. This is not just a normal shirt. This is the shirt touched by the body of the holy Imam. And because of that, you know, link of that shirt with that Imam, it acquires barakah. And we have the example in the Quran. You look at the example of Yaqub and Yusuf alayhi salam. You see, Quran talks about it, that when Yusuf sent his shirt, where was he in Egypt, and where was Yaqub? Somewhere in Canaan. Far away. But the impact was there. When Yaqub touches that shirt of Yusuf, you know, his sight comes back. You will say, well, he's a Nabi and he's also a Nabi. But the fact is that it shows that, you know, a shirt of a Nabi has that kind of an impact there. And so this is not shirk and bid'at if we look at it from the perspective of, you know, shafa'at and tawassul.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.